Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at theopenhouse.net.au blog site.
How much do you really know about Islam? In fact, how much do you really know about Muslims in general? Tonight we're going to explore what Muslims really think about life, faith and relations with the West based on a survey of tens of thousands of Muslims over a period of 6 years. John Esposito is Professor of International Affairs and Islamic Studies at Georgetown University. He's also the founding director of the Prince Al-Walid bin Talal Center for Muslim-Christian Understanding. He's also a senior scientist with the Gallup Organization, and the Gallup Organization have done this mammoth survey of Muslims around the world. And the result is a book called Who Speaks for Islam, of which John is co-author. John Esposito, thanks for joining us on Open House.
Oh, thanks. I'm happy to be here.
This is a mammoth poll, isn't it? The Gallup World Poll. Tens of thousands of Muslims surveyed face-to-face between 2001 and 2007.
Yes, it's basically the largest, most comprehensive survey of Muslims ever done. It represents the voices of 1 billion Muslims. You know, most polls, however good, are more or less ad hoc. You know, an issue comes up, then one goes out and does a quick survey. But this is a sustained survey. It's part of Gallup's World Poll, which is a poll of 90% of the world's countries. And it's a poll that continues to be done and will be done every year for the next 100 years.
Now, tens of thousands of people, what was the actual figure? And it was in 35 countries, I believe. How did you actually do tens of thousands of interviews with people face-to-face anyway?
Well, it's basically roughly 35 to 40 countries from North Africa to Southeast Asia, approximately 50,000 one-on-one interviews. And these interviews are done in-country, done by people who are local, and done in local languages. But what makes it also a remarkably significant and accurate survey is that countries are gridded so that you're not only in urban areas, you're in urban, village, and rural areas. You do it according to sex, socioeconomic, as well as age differences. So you really get a very representative sampling of people within each country surveyed.
All right. Well, you talk about the silent majority of Islam that you have surveyed. Tell me what surprised you most about the research.
Well, first, in a selfish way, it tended to confirm a lot of things that I've been writing about. But
right.
I think what surprised me most was the extent to which one could document how, in a number of critical areas, the reality in the Muslim world differed with the conventional wisdom. I mean, part of the problem most people have today, most policymakers have, is that they're caught between the contending positions of experts, whether they're academic, terrorism experts. They all have great credentials, and they all tell you what Muslims believe or want to do. Here you have a chance to actually hear the voices of Muslims on things like, why do they hate us? Do they hate the West? How do they feel about democracy? How do they feel about women, violence, and you don't have to rely on individual experts for that.
All right. Well, I'd love to explore each of those areas because I think it's quite fascinating what you've been able to uncover. Let's start with the violence aspect because that's top of mind for a lot of people. It could well be simply a case of the extremist minority colouring the silent majority, as you call it. But let's talk about that. How has Islam come to be associated with violence, I guess, so strongly in the West now?
Well, I think that, you know, the reality of it is that, you know, for many people in the West, when I got into the field in the late 60s and early 70s, most people said I would never get a job. I was trained in Catholic theology. I had been in a monastery for 10 years. Huh. I had a master's degree. I was teaching theology. And in America in the late 60s and early 70s, as in Europe, or Australia, Islam was relatively invisible. They were Muslims, but most people weren't aware of mosques, Islamic centers, or what Muslims believed. But in that context in which you know nothing, suddenly what people began to experience as Muslims were the images of Iranians during the Iranian Revolution, the image of people who were engaged in hostage-taking, etc. And if you have no context within which to understand a religion, the logical thing to say is, well, I'm looking at them, and this is what they're saying.
Mm.
But that would be a bit like looking at reports on the extent and the incredible extent of pedophilia within Catholicism and then drawing the conclusion that this is what Catholicism is about.
Mm.
You know, but for most people, whether it's in Europe, America, or Australia, we can sort out the stuff that deals with, if you will, the extremists or the deviants in Judaism and Christianity, because we live and come out of that context. But when you're dealing with a group that you know nothing about, it's very easy to generalize from, if you will, the militant kind of minority. And they're the ones that get the media's attention. You know, when Osama bin Laden speaks, the entire media listens.
Yes, absolutely. Interesting that the poll found that 7% of respondents to your survey thought that the September 11 attacks were, quote, completely justified. What did you draw out of that 7%? What meaning can you associate with that?
Well, I think what's very interesting about it is that you've got 7%, and that's a number to be concerned about, because 7% of the world's Muslims is 91 million people.
Hmm.
But when you actually look at this 91 million, the people we call sort of potential radicals or the politically radicalized, they're not people who themselves engage in violence. And their profiles tend to be people who are no more religious than the mainstream. They're better educated. They're more internationally aware. They're more successful. But what's very surprising is they're also people who, more than the mainstream, believe that democracy is the way forward, and that dialogue with the West is important. But in opposition to the mainstream, there are people who believe that that's never going to happen, that in fact the West has had and continues to have a double standard when it comes to the promotion of democracy in the Muslim world, because they would argue, look at the kind of governments the West supports. They're mostly authoritarian. So what you wind up with is a group of people who are feeling more alienated and marginalized. But interestingly enough, again, there are people who are very optimistic about their own futures, but are pessimistic about the future of their country and their region. Because, in other words, they see the authoritarian regimes in the Muslim world. They see the extent to which Western governments, no matter what they say, at the end of the day, support authoritarian regimes. And so their biggest fear is Western invasion, as in Iraq, Western intervention, and Western domination. So the conclusion that I draw is these are the people that one should be focusing on. In other words, if you're going to fight a war against global terrorism, the military goes after the terrorists. They can kill, capture, and contain. But if you're going to fight the war of, if you will, ideas to win the hearts and minds, you don't have to win the hearts and minds of the mainstream. You've got to win the hearts and minds of the people that we call the politically radicalized.
Right. Fascinating. John Esposito is with us. We're talking about this massive Gallup survey. It's resulted in a book called Who Speaks for Islam? Theopenhouse.net.au carries the podcast. Well, that's quite fascinating. And again, John, just shows how complex this is. It's not a simple matter at all. What do exactly the majority think of that 7%, quote-unquote, minority, that small amount of radicalized or nearly radicalized people?
Well, I think that when you compare the majority to the minority, the majority of people who believe that 9/11 is not acceptable, the majority have their resentments of the West, but in fact the majority, along with the minority, are people who demonstrate that there is no blind hatred of the West. If you look at the statistics on Muslim attitudes towards the West, what you see very clearly is that majorities of Muslims across the world distinguish between America and Britain and most of the other countries in the world, and particularly between Bush and Blair, if you look at this, you know, the rates of disapproval, and let's say the leadership at that time of Germany and France. So you see a clear demarcation. It's not as if this is a blind sort of hatred of the West. And the other thing that you see is that majorities of Muslims, while they may resent what they see as the denigration of Islam and looking upon Muslims as if they're inferior, they admire the West for its technology, its freedoms, its work ethic, its human rights. So again, it's not, you know, that image that we had after 9/11. Why do they hate us? They hate us because of who we are, you know, our democracy, our freedoms.
Yeah.
It's a very careful kind of distinction. But the mainstream differ from the extremist, or if you will, the politically radicalized, in that while they are concerned about issues of Western intervention, they are more concerned and more primary in their emphasis on the desire for, A, more respect, and B, for technological and economic assistance in terms of development.
Right. The whole concept of jihad needs to be explored as well. From what I understand from the book, that concept is understood differently from that politically radicalized group we were talking about to, compared to the mainstream majority of Muslims.
Yeah. I mean, the reality of it, it's kind of interesting. I just came back from Southeast Asia in a quick trip to Malaysia and Indonesia and Singapore. Well, that I go to fairly regularly, but I was talking to a friend who's an American expert who's lived in Southeast Asia for 40 years, and we were talking about the fact that, you know, if you look at the two broad meanings of jihad, the broadest meaning of jihad, as seen in the Quran, is to strive and struggle in the path of God. In other words, to strive to be a good Muslim, to be moral in a world that often tempts you to be immoral. Mm. And then the other is the striving and struggle to defend your community, i.e., if you're attacked, you have a perfect right to fight back. But the third iteration is that which departs from the notion of defending Islam or Muslims as in defensive warfare, and in fact engaging in offensive warfare, which is what the terrorists do. But the fact is, for many Muslims, the popular notion of jihad continues to be, you know, people talk about, when they're talking about something that takes effort, you know, to achieve in one's life, to be good, to achieve certain things in your life or for your community, they use the term jihad. But where we have a problem today is that extremists and terrorists hijack that term.
Okay. So we've got three versions of the understanding of jihad being understood.
Exactly.
out in the Muslim world. We've got what you call a silent majority, who actually are not as radicalized as we would be led to believe, because that's actually a small minority, so to speak. Now, you touched on this before, but the whole idea of the Islamic understanding of the West, there's a certain interest there, as you said, about the technology, about the freedoms and things like that. We also hear these phrases, and again, you can put us right on this, but there's a good majority of Muslims, and particularly Muslim leaders, who are out to kind of convert and take the world. What do they really want? What do the majority of Muslims really want when it comes to the world, when it comes to the West, when it comes to, I guess, the furthering of the Islamic kingdom?
Well, I think that one of the things you have to consider, I mean, I always find it humorous when, for example, people quite rightly in their concerns raise that kind of question. But, you know, being a longtime Christian I won't say how many years, but it's getting close to 70, and having been in a monastery for 10 years, it's kind of funny when you look at a world in which evangelical Christians and others are sweeping the world seeking converts. And so then somebody says something like, oh, gee, there's something inherently kind of dangerous because we hear that Muslims want to convert everybody. Well, the fact is, Muslims are as diverse as Christians are today. If you look at most Christian churches, you find enormous differences between what one might call, and I use these terms, I mean, not so that your listenership is not offended, I'm using the broadest possible terms, but there are enormous differences between what one might call, let's say, conservative and fundamentalist, I'm not equating the two, and let's say more liberal mainstream Christians when it comes to the whole question of missionizing. But the reality of it is, if you live in Africa, if you live in South and Latin America, if you live in many parts of the world, you see yourself inundated by missionaries. After we went into Iraq and, quote, successfully invaded it, i.e. overthrew Saddam, you had major Western missionaries, and it was quoted in Time magazine and other places, saying this was an act of God. You know, what America did is open up Iraq for conversion. Mm. And in fact, you had a lot of Christians who were indigenous in Iraq, in effect saying, we've been here almost since the time of St. Paul, and now we've got these Western Christians acting as if there are no Christians living here. So I think that even when you talk about, you know, Muslims, there's an enormous diversity. And if you're talking about mainstream Muslims, for many mainstream Muslims, they're content to live their life. They'd love to see people become Muslim, but they, you know, feel that if people want to become Muslim, they're there to explain their faith. And also, there are Muslims who want to spread the word, who want to engage in missionary activity.
Yes. And John, what do those Muslims that are living in what we might call those totalitarian Muslim countries, you talk about North Africa, where the Sharia law, from what we can see as Westerners looking at it, looks to be terribly extreme, particularly when it comes to if you fall outside of that law. How do Muslims, the silent majority you're talking about, how do they feel about living in those countries?
Well, this is the interesting thing. I mean, in terms of, like, getting the reality straight, I mean, I often say I've got the best job in the world. I've been in my profession for more than 30 years, and people ask me the same questions all the time. Hmm. And over the years, I get paid more and more money for answering them. But, I mean, you know, the reality of it is that it is countries like Sudan and the Taliban in Afghanistan.
Afghanistan, yeah.
You know what I mean? And, you know, they really raise issues, but I find often when I give talks, people say exactly the kind of question that many would lead you to, you know, ask me the question, well, what about North Africa? The fact is, North Africa has no major Sharia rule, but North Africa does have incredibly authoritarian regimes. Mm. But sure, I mean, for people in Sudan, there are clearly some people who support, let's say, the Sudanese model. But for many Sudanese, it's a major problem, and that's been a case for 20 years. I mean, there are major resistance. There clearly are, and I would mention this, in our poll, what we see are majorities of Muslims, men and women, many of whom would like to see democracy but don't want an absolute secularism and rather want to see Sharia as a source of law. But they mean many different things. For many of them, what they really are saying is, we want a country that's based on political participation, freedoms, but also a religiously based morality. Now, that's a lot different than people who say, I want Sharia, and Sharia for them is what I call no-no Islam. You know, a kind of sort of negative, kind of punishment-oriented Islam. And clearly, majorities of Muslims don't want that. Yes, they want to follow God's will, and they're willing to make the sacrifices that Muslims, Christians, and Jews do in terms of, you know, following, let's say, a form of morality. But they're certainly not self-destructive in their faith.
John Esposito is with us on Open House tonight. We're talking about a massive poll done by the Gallup organization. 50,000 Muslims face-to-face interviewed, basically equating to the views of a billion Muslims right around the world. A huge research project. Theopenhouse.net.au has the podcast as well. John, let's talk about women then. We also think about veiled women. We talk about how some of them are oppressed. Tell me what your research found out about the status of Muslim women and how they feel about their beliefs and their faith.
Well, this is very interesting. I mean, I've done research and travel regularly from North Africa to Southeast Asia. And the reality of it is that in some Muslim countries, women are oppressed. There's no doubt about it. And women have to deal with issues of violence, both, you know, within the family and second-class sort of status. Mm. But the reality of it is when you poll across the Muslim world, what you discover is for majorities of Muslim women, they don't deny the fact that some of their sisters have bad situations that need to be corrected. We deal with this in the West itself, where violence against women in some countries is rather significant. Mm. But their primary concerns are with regard to issues of development and peace, i.e. the education of women, the employment of women. In other words, they see that the way forward for women is to get recognition of equal rights in society, equal rights to education, etc. And what our polling shows is, and this is a bit surprising, not only majorities of women, but majorities of men in most Muslim countries believe that women have equal legal rights, equal rights to education, equal rights to employment, and equal rights to senior positions in government and society. Hmm. And this is rather surprising because in a number of Muslim countries, you do not see those rights. Hmm. And so the logical question is, why this gap or this disjuncture? And the response, of course, is take a look at the nature of many of these governments. They are authoritarian. they are patriarchal, and that's still a struggle that Muslim women, and indeed Muslim men, you know, have to deal with.
So there really seems to be a mismatch between the beliefs of those in leadership, and it might well be governmental leadership. We could also look at the broader phenomenon of religion, that often there's a mismatch between the beliefs of those who are in religious leadership as well, and those in the pews, those actually everyday people.
Exactly. I mean, I always tell my students when I speak that my analogies are terrible, but, you know, look at China. You know, today, one would look at China, and we've got, you know, the games. You know, one could raise a lot of questions, given the nature of the Chinese government, what are we doing there and giving them this level of legitimacy? Mm. But if you look at China, you've got this outwardly prosperous country, but when you look very closely, what do you see? You see an authoritarian regime. And what are the implications for religion? The fact is the Chinese give their rubber stamp to the forms of religion they approve of, and they ban or repress many of the mainstream Christian and Muslim organizations. And I think that often we miss that a bit when we're dealing with Muslim countries. Consider the fact that most Arab countries are referred to as mukhabarat states. Mukhabarat means security states. That means you've got governments that are not really democratically elected and that rely on their security forces and their military for their stability and their legitimacy. And I think a lot of people forget that, and a lot of Westerners who go as tourists don't even see it.
Well, John, bring it down to some simple things. I know that's probably a horrible thing to ask you as a researcher with this amazing body of material that you've actually got. But what if you were to bring it down to one or two things, what would you like Christians to understand most then about Islam and Muslims?
I think I'd like them to understand what I came to understand. I was raised in a Catholic Christian background. I had studied Hinduism and Buddhism, knew a fair amount about Judaism, and I had no interest when the chairman of my department of religion at Temple University said I should study Islam, and I refused at first. I thought, I don't know anything about Arabs and Muslims, and a little bit I know from the media years ago, I thought, why would you want to study these people? And then I began to study Islam, only agreed to take one course, and I suddenly discovered that there wasn't just a Judeo-Christian, there was a Judeo-Christian Islamic tradition. And when I started to travel across the Muslim world, not simply relying on people in the media or books written by whomever, often that contend with each other, you know, I discovered that the majority of Muslims, like the majority of Jews and Christians, are people who are believers in God, have a sense of morality, believe in reward and punishment, believe in hard work, are concerned about their families. And I think that that's what we often forget. If we knew nothing about Christianity and we just saw it in terms of Northern Ireland, what would a non-Christian think of Protestants and Catholics? Mm. And I think the challenge for most people in, if you will, the Western world, is really to get beyond the extremist voices and take the time to find out what are the majorities of Muslims like. When you make a comparison to another people, religiously or political, the tendency we all do is to compare our ideal to somebody else's reality. Mm-hmm. The challenge is to compare my ideal as a Christian to a Muslim's ideal, and then to say, look, let's also compare that to the reality base.
Right,
but
yeah,
then compare my reality to somebody else's reality.
Okay.
We often don't do that.
Yeah. John, I asked you what you would like Christians to understand about Muslims. Let me just ask you one final question. What you would like Muslims to understand then about Christians? Is it any different to what you've just said?
It's similar, but, you know, what I say to many of my Muslim friends is, look, a lot of Christians don't take the time to understand Islam, but a significant minority of Christians have become professionals in understanding Islam and working at it. There may be diverse positions, but we spend a good deal of time. And I encourage a lot of my Muslim friends in other parts of the Muslim world and say to them, yeah, there's been a lot of oppression in the past, European colonialism, you can move it up to American neocolonialism, but it's very important for Muslims themselves to come to look beyond their faith in understanding Christians and to actually spend time listening to Christians in terms of why do they believe what they believe? Mm-hmm. In other words, I'm asking them to do very much what I say to Christians. Mm-hmm. What I say to Christians is, if you want to understand Muslims, bracket your belief and your judgments, and first try to read and understand what do Muslims say they believe and why. Then make your judgments. But don't start as a Christian, and as soon as you go to look at Islam, say, wait a minute, they believe this? Oh, well, that's against Christianity. So I'm immediately not going to listen to the rest of the story. Yeah. I think that's the challenge for both Muslims and Christians.
Yes, yeah, a listening posture. John, fascinating to talk to you. I do appreciate your time. Thanks so much for joining us on Open House.
Great. Had great fun. Thank you.
Yeah. That's John Esposito. Quite a bio shoot, you could say. Professor of International Affairs and Islamic Studies at Georgetown University, the founding director of the Prince Al-Walid bin Talal Center for Muslim Christian Understanding, and also a senior scientist with the Gallup Organization, who's done this massive research poll right across the world over 6 years of 50,000 Muslims. The book is called Who Speaks for Islam?
We hope you enjoyed this Open House podcast. To hear more from Open House, visit theopenhouse.net.au.